everybody out there in podcast land. Welcome to episode number 153 of eBay the Right Way. Today's date is February 21st, 2024, and my guest is Jess in Canada. Announcements. March 24th marks the 3-year anniversary of my podcast. Thanks to you all, the eBay community, for providing so much great content. Let's do an anniversary episode with a montage of your stories. Funny, customer, reselling stories, things you have sold, the life of an eBay seller, just keeping it fun and light. Anything goes. Everyone is welcome, previous guests included. So, how will we do this? The format will be like the estate sale and jewelry episodes, with several different sellers contributing. All I need from you is a short audio recording, which you can do on your smartphone. Most of them have this feature, and you can send it to me either as an email attachment, you can text it to me, however you want to do it. And my contact info is below the podcast. If you prefer to text, just send me a Facebook message or an email and I will provide the phone number. So reach out if you want to be part of this fun episode. And let's celebrate the eBay community. Okay, now for the conversation with Jess.
Welcome back, listeners. I have Jess with us today. And tell us where you're located.
I'm in Vancouver, Canada.
Oh, I did not know you were in Canada.
Yeah.
Okay. I think you're like maybe my third Canadian guest.
There needs to be more of us. Canadian resellers hey, strong.
Yeah, they reach out, you know, come on. So how's your weather?
Unseasonably warm.
Really?
Yeah. It's been a weird winter. We haven't been able to go skiing or snowboarding really at all. All the mountains are closed. It's wet. It's warm. It's the West Coast.
Perfect weather to not be able to do anything in it.
Pretty much. Just head down and work.
Okay. All right. So we always start off with what brought you to eBay and when?
Sure. Well, my husband and I started some casual reselling like way back in 2012. And at the time, that show Storage Wars was really popular and everybody was watching it. And we were like, gosh, I wonder if they do that here in Vancouver. And we found out that, in fact, they did at the time. And we found an auction. We went there. I remember this auction taking all day, which is not how they usually go. And there were tons of people there. We bought the last unit that they auctioned that day. We paid about $200 for it. And inside there, we found a whole bunch of stuff, but the highlight was this big collection of Royal Albert Old Country roses, which is, you know, it's not a high-end pattern, but it's a very collectible pattern. And it was this huge set in perfect condition. And it was all the earlier pieces from the 1960s. And we did really well reselling that. And we were like, gosh, this is so easy. And so we kept buying lockers and it just kept rolling. It was a good side hustle for a couple of years, but my husband was doing a really physical job that was hard on his body. And in the end, we were having so much fun with reselling and it was growing so organically that he quit his job and I still kept doing my consulting work on the side and I was teaching at the university here and eventually quit that too. And now we're both full-time in the business and I've got my own podcast about reselling and we're all in.
Okay. We're going to get to your podcast cool. For sure. So just a couple of reactions to what you just said. Yes. I remember that whole Storage Wars, reality TV thing. I always go back to thinking those are staged. You just, I just don't think I think it's manufactured reality. And most people just think they're watching something real and it's, well, of course they have to set it up so it's interesting. So they don't want to have a whole episode of nothing being in those storage units or like nothing but trash or whatever.
Oh, absolutely. But it was interesting when we used to do this because they don't have live auctions really in Vancouver at all anymore. But back then when they did, there was this monthly auction train that used to happen through all the public storage facilities throughout our region. And we would go, and it was amazing how similar to the TV show the people were who came to the auctions. Like, we were like the Jared and Brandy, and you had your Dave, and you had your old man Barry who just like bid on everything and overpaid for one little treasure he saw in the corner. Those people were really part of our group, and it was so funny, the similarities. And then so many times we would buy a unit and go into it and, you know, lift up a blanket and there'd be a safe underneath, and we're like, why aren't they filming this? Like, it was weird how the parallels actually did happen. So I believed a lot of what I saw on the show, and I don't think that they planted stuff, but I do think, I mean, you know, 90% of what you buy turns out to be junk. Like, the lockers, you still make money, but you throw out a lot of stuff. I do think that, you know, they have to follow them through like a lot of units to find those surprises. But they do happen, and they did happen. And I've got all kinds of stories about that that I can share.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's great. I hope you will share them. And if you don't get them all on this episode, we'll have you back on to talk about them again. Well, that's great that you dove in and you made it work. And it wasn't just beginner's luck. It was an actual business model. So
yeah, it kind of just happened by accident. But I mean, for like, I have a business background. I have a few degrees. I've got an MBA, and I used to teach business, and I really enjoyed like taking those traditional business problems and economic problems and like figuring out how to apply them to reselling. Because most of us get into this pretty organically. Like, we just find something, we flip it, and we're like, oh, cool, that's fun. And a lot of people have those similar stories. But I was like, what, how do I take the principles of marketing and apply it to, you know? And that's kind of what I've been doing. And that's a lot of the extra fun that I get out of it.
How many items do you have for sale?
On eBay, about 7,000.
7,000? Oh, wow. Do you specialize in anything?
So I'm more about building like kind of a brand than I am about specializing in a particular niche. Well, you guys say niche. I say niche. You say
whatever.
Niche.
I don't even use the word. I just say category.
Fair. I like that better, actually. But some of our favorite categories are in sort of the collectibles arena. So we love comic books. That's our favorite thing to find. We really know that category very, very well. We've also done very well with die-cast cars. But then we have sort of smaller categories that we really like, things like lighters, you know, and license plates and stuff like that. So that it's mainly collectibles. But, you know, I think like a lot of sellers, if you find something profitable, you might as well throw it up on eBay.
Are you willing to share your numbers, like how many items a month you sell and what kind of either revenue or profit that brings in for you?
So we are usually shipping 400 to 500 items a month. That's the volume that we're targeting. And of course, that fluctuates from time to time. When I started my podcast, I wanted to pose the question of whether it was possible to sell $1 million worth of stuff in a year, like gross revenue. And just kind of the podcast is about exploring that question. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to explore that question, you know, that's kind of going to be our target, right? Like, to try and get there. And we're not there. But, you know, it's definitely a solid full-time income for both of us. We're definitely as comfortable as we've ever been. And trying to grow that through smart sourcing, I really feel like sourcing the best items is the key to actually building up that multiple six-figure revenue to seven figures. You know, that's what we're working on. I quit teaching at the university to do this because it made more money. So I'm definitely not going to stop anytime soon.
What was your professional career as a teacher?
Yeah, I started in academic administration, actually a lot of secretarial work, and kind of built my way into some management. But I had a Bachelor of Education, and I was always interested in teaching. So I had started to teach at that same college where I was an administrator. I started to teach a couple of continuing ed classes there and eventually in a diploma program. And then I started my consulting business, helping startup companies get loans to start their businesses. And I worked on that for a while. And that opportunity led me to do some guest speaking at the University of British Columbia here in Vancouver. And then I got headhunted. So I ended up teaching there. I was just a part-time instructor there for about 4 years. I did that through the pandemic and just a little bit on the other side of it.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, teachers are not well compensated. They're very important. And, you know, that's just a problem with our society is they're just, I don't think they're valued and paid for what they're worth. Without teachers, you know, where would we be?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I had originally started as a high school teacher, and that was just financially kind of disastrous. And I think that's true almost anywhere you go in North America. The university here is pretty prestigious, and definitely the pay was more than fair, but it was still did not compare to what we were doing in our business. And every time I would go back to teach at the end of the semester, we'd be like, I think that cost us more revenue than I made.
Right. Exactly.
You know, so it just wasn't worth it in the end.
So for the listeners, when I reach out to sellers to have them on the podcast, I just kind of say, hey, I'd love to have you on the podcast. How do you feel? And probably 75% of the people say they don't want to do it. They just aren't comfortable speaking, or they don't think their business is good enough, big enough, whatever. And so you jumped right on it. And we did not discuss anything. I didn't look at your store because I like this to be organic. We're just two people talking. So yeah, my reactions are real. So now I want to dive into this 7,000 item inventory and talk to you about, you know, how you store it, how what your average day is like since both of you are full time, because I didn't know any of that. And I think that makes for a better podcast when the host doesn't know everything. So where do you want to start with all that?
I guess I could do sort of a day in the life kind of walkthrough. I mean, we got into a warehouse a few years ago that's really close to where we live, and we were very fortunate to get into this space. It's about 2,000 square feet. And it's really not big enough for what we're doing, but we make it work just through efficient use of space. Our eBay store is mostly in the back, sort of the back half. And the front is for bringing, you know, we have like the bay door, we're bringing in inventory, sorting it, cleaning, processing, photography. And then my little office area is out in the front where we do our shipping. And so that's kind of how the space is set up. And a typical day for us would be, you know, if it's a shipping day, which is 3 days a week, we're going down, pulling all of our orders, getting all the packages made and getting the labels out. Then I'll usually hit photography for a couple of hours. Then we'd go drop off the packages, and then I'll go home and work on, if it's not listing, then it's going to be administrative stuff or recording a podcast episode or something like that. And then if we have staff, which we do have like staff who come in, especially when we have a lot of inventory, we have a lot of photography that needs to be done. We bring people in for those projects so we can get more photos done. And then I have two people who do listing for me that work remotely. So items that are a little bit more repetitive, or like, you know, if I have a whole project that's just books or something like that, I just set up a process, assign them a task, and then they list all of that stuff for me. So that's how we're able to grow and maintain that many listings. There's no way that the two of us could do it just ourselves. So having that help is like really critical to the scale that we've reached.
How long did it take you to get to 7,000 items from ground zero?
I remember that we hit 4,000 in 2020. So it's been a bit of a slow trajectory from there. I mean, of course, it's because we just keep selling stuff. So that's not a bad problem to have. But we didn't actually get going on eBay probably, I want to say, until about 4 years into our reselling. We were doing everything locally, and we started eBay like around 2016, I would say, 2017 maybe. And yeah, we just started with like 8 to 10 items, but our account was old. We had a legacy account, so we didn't have any selling limits, which I know new sellers have now. Mm-hmm. So we started with no limits, and that was really great. So we were able to just list as much as we wanted immediately. That's a long time. That's like 7-8 years of selling on eBay, getting up to 7,000 listings. I'd like to be at 10, but if I keep selling stuff and can't get to 10, that's definitely not a bad problem.
As long as the money is working for you, the number of items really isn't that important? I mean, it is something tangible you can count and work towards, definitely. And the fact that you have all that space, and I like that you have your eBay world set up in that warehouse so that you can get away from it.
Oh, goodness. Yes. I couldn't imagine. Yeah. When we started, we were doing everything out of our house and then the garage behind our house. And we were just like, okay, this is not going to work. We have to get a separate space.
Yeah. I like that. You know, it's from a cost benefit analysis, doing it out of your home is great because you're not paying extra rent on a storage unit or a warehouse. But when you get to the size you are, that can definitely take over everything. Inventory creep is a real problem.
Huge. And it doesn't matter what scale you're at either. It's like you can just have like your bedroom closet and you'll burst out of it. And then you have a warehouse like we do and you burst out of it. Like it's just, that's just how this industry works.
It's just like a flood. It just keeps overflowing, like the Titanic. It overflows into the next bulkhead and the next and the next. And pretty soon you have it in every room and running out of space. And I can, for a life balance, life work balance perspective, I think when you get to that size, it is wise to have a separate location, but you're doing everything. You're cleaning, photographing, shipping, everything from there. So it's just like, quote, a real job where you leave home and go to your office and do your stuff. And then you can come home and you're probably on your phone or a laptop, you know, checking stuff all evening, but at least you don't have it in your face all day.
Yeah, I think it's a very like clutter-filled lifestyle reselling and being able to get away from that. Like, I think there's so much energy and stuff, you know, like things carry energy. And so if you have that like creeping in on you all the time, it just doesn't make you feel good. And so it is super important that we're able to get out of it. I mean, not to say that we don't use part of our home for storage, because we absolutely do, but it still stays out of our actual living area.
Right. How far away is your warehouse from your home?
Like 5 minutes drive.
Oh, perfect. Yeah.
Yeah.
Close enough, but not like next door within walking distance where you're tempted to go over there all the time.
Yeah. Although, yeah, it's pretty close. Like, yeah, it's, we do go there a lot, and we're in an industrial area. So we have like the recycling facilities and like the lantern, the transfer station, and like everything is all right there. So we, it's really easy to just do like a circle and, you know, drop off your donations, drop off your recycling. You know, when we go through big bulk purchases, which is how we like to buy stuff, you always have garbage, you always have recycling. And you can't have that lying around. So we're fortunate to be really close to the facilities that'll take those items so that we can just get them out of our space as fast as possible.
Well, it sounds like you have it physically organized very well. So I commend you on that. Now, I'm going to ask this question about your buyers, and then we're going to get into some things you've sold. Do you sell a lot to the United States and worldwide? And how's the shipping costs on those items? How do you navigate that?
Sure. Yeah. Reselling in Canada is a slightly different animal. We do sell about 80% of our inventory to the United States. And we're fortunate to be in an urban area. We have access to what's called a cross-border shipper. So this is essentially a broker, and a broker is going to give us access to USPS rates, plus they add their little margin on top so that they make money. And we're able to ship to the US for a fairly competitive price. It's still not as cheap as we could if we were actually in the United States, but it's close, and it gives us the opportunity to be competitive with American sellers. This is a big problem for Canadians. A lot of Canadian resellers try to work out of rural areas, or they don't have access to these brokerage services, and the shipping costs for them are very expensive. Canada Post is one of the most expensive carriers in the world. So if I were to ship a hat, let's just call it like a baseball cap, using Canada Post from here to Los Angeles, it would probably cost me, if I were to convert to US dollars, maybe $15 to ship a hat. And, you know, buyers don't want to buy that, right? But I'll ship it with my broker, and I'll still charge $7, which is still a bit high, I think, for a lot of buyers. But if they really want that hat, seven on top of maybe an American would charge $3 or $4. It's not that big of a leap. So we're still able to do it. Now, there's been some developments in Canadian reselling, and there's a few other services that are now being offered that people in rural areas can access that are still, you know, that helps them with the shipping costs. But it's definitely a challenge. And everywhere you live in Canada, the services are a little bit different. So I can't just give advice and say, how can a Canadian reseller do this? And it's like, well, because do you live in Manitoba? Do you live, like, where do you live? And it all depends. So Vancouver has totally different access to brokerages than like Calgary or Toronto, for example.
Okay. So it's, you got to figure it out based on where you are.
Yeah, you do. And it's not that easy. Plus we've discovered that like we can list on ebay.ca, the Canadian version, but to make all your money, you got to list on .com. As soon as you list on .com, like you get more visibility on your items and the pricing makes sense to American buyers and you sell more stuff, but then you can't set up calculated shipping because you're in Canada and you're listing on a US website. So it just gets so complicated.
Well, it sounds like you've got it figured out. And I remember Sherry in Nova Scotia talking about this is why she sells more expensive higher end items is because the shipping isn't really going to matter. If it's collectible, if it's rare, if it's truly limited in number, that collector or person is going to pay what it takes to get that item. Not absolutely that she's overcharging, but she's shipping out of Canada. So it's complicated as far as what to charge for shipping. And it's going to be more if it's going anywhere.
Yeah, no, it is. And especially out in Nova Scotia. I don't think Halifax has a cross-border broker. They might have one now. But yeah, it's definitely a challenge. But that point is absolutely true. If the item is unique and the buyer wants it badly enough, they are willing to pay the shipping. And so that's just something like, I think like mentally just Canadian sellers need to get over, like charge what you have to charge. And yeah, like she did, it sounds like she found success to selling things that were at a higher average price. And that's a formula that's probably going to work.
Yeah. And it goes back to that saying, an item is worth what someone will pay for it. You know, one person will say, how could you pay $300 for a stuffed animal? And the other person that had that as a child is like, oh my gosh, there it is. I'm getting it. You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what's so fun about what we do. Like just getting like those treasures out of like, you know, like we get stuff that's literally going in the trash. And then like, it's not just about getting the money for it, but then that person's like so happy to get it. And it's like, you know, like 5 minutes later, that would have been in the landfill and that person would have never been happy.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know if you heard, I'm getting ready to move, hopefully for the last time, and going through my inventory and thinning it out, you know, things I've had a really long time that has no interest, or I only paid 50 cents for it and it has no interest and it's big, but I've got like four tubs of plush. And that's something that sells for me in my store. And it's like, oh, keeping that. Most of them are small, like 6 to 8 inches. So those I will hang on to until they sell, because so many times one of them sells and I've had it for a couple of years and it's, oh, I had this as a child, or, you know, my daughter had this and I can't find it anywhere. And so, yeah, those things are like gold. I'm hanging on to those. And they're light, not going to be hard to move. They're not going to be like 100 coffee mugs or something.
Plush is like a surprising category. I actually sold a plush this morning from, it was like a Vancouver 2010 Olympics, like set of plush mascots. And I'm like, oh, there it goes. Like, it always kind of surprises me. And plush, like you can squish it. Like,
yeah, you can squish it down. Put it in space bags and suck that air out. And it's easy to store and lightweight to move if you have to. I may use the throw it over the balcony method. I'm on the third floor and people do this all the time. Like if it's lightweight and not going to break, you know, they just toss it over. So I'm going to put my like clothing and plush stuff, linen, stuff that's not breakable in like lawn and leaf bags, and then just drop it over. So I don't have to carry it down the stairs.
Efficiency. I like that.
And it's like, I was talking to my neighbor across the hall and I'm like, we need like a pulley system or And an elevator would have been nice, but we need a pulley system or something for taking things up and down so we don't have to carry them. But yeah, that's never going to happen. So I'm thinking, like, how can I do this where it's fewer trips up and down the stairs? But where I'm going is all one level with a full basement. So I'm going to have tons of room. I can't wait to dive in. I don't think I'm going to get to 7,000 items. I don't know. I might. Because I'll have somebody helping me that's interested in the business. So, you know, two people can do a lot more work. But I'm excited about having more space and not having all these stairs. Because
oh, yeah.
I'll see those small TVs with the built-in VCR player that they use for gaming and stuff. I see those all the time, but I don't get them because, all right, I'm going to have to bring that all the way up the stairs, store it, and then when it sells, bring it back down. And
yeah,
I have been avoiding a lot of items for the past few years as an apartment dweller. And I always get on a high floor because there's nobody above you and it's cheaper. Because nobody wants the top floors. But anyway, yeah, so I think you're going to be my role model for building that business big again, because I'm very excited about finding more stuff that I've been avoiding because of where I live. So that is a great segue into, let's talk about some things that you've sold or some of those storage unit stories you've got.
Oh gosh, where do I even start? Okay, well, I did tease a storage unit story, so I'll give a way back story. So this was when this was an auction that almost nobody came to, and I don't know why. But this day there was not very many people at the auction, and we won a unit. It was a fairly large unit, $200 and something, I think. And it wasn't full, but it had like three rows that were kind of piled up from front to back of this unit. And, you know, like usually when you get a unit, you kind of can sort of put together the story of the person who had it, like just through their stuff, you kind of learn something about them. This one was so weird. It had everything from like Arc'teryx, like ski gear, to like weird old toys, to like, it had some like bags and purses that were mostly counterfeit, but then some of them weren't. And then it had all these, this like couple boxes of like antiques. And, you know, usually you pull out an antique, you're like, oh, this looks super old. And it turns out to be a copy. I mean, like 90% of the time, that's what happens. But there was this box. It was like an old wooden milk box. And then there were like two or three statues inside. We still have two of them, which are really unusual. And we have to figure them out one day. It's been 10 years. We'll do it sometime. Anyway.
that's on your later day list. And
oh, man. Yeah. There's always those things where like, we'll get to later. And you're like, it's been a decade. Anyway. we pulled out this one statue and it was Tinkerbell. Okay. So we're like, this is cool. And it was porcelain. And we're like, this is really interesting. We turned it over. It had a maker's mark on the bottom. I had no idea what this was, but the feel of it, like it just didn't feel new, you know, like it, you can kind of tell when you're holding stuff, it's got a weight to it. You look at the quality of the paint, the quality of the ceramic. It's like, this is not modern. So I started doing some research and I found it's by a maker called Lenchi. Now Lenchi, as I learned, was really popular for making like puppets and stuff sort of in the, I don't know, I want to say like the 1940s, 30s to 50s kind of Italian maker. And then I did some more research and I found out that Lenchi had met Walt Disney, and Walt Disney had commissioned Lenchi to make some of the first ever figurines of Disney characters. And we had one. Wow. And we were like, what? And I verified it. I went through a couple of different sources. I tried to find people who knew about Italian pottery. And I was like, what do you think? And it was like, yeah, I mean, it all came back legit. And we were like, this is crazy. Like, how did this get here? And I remember we sold it for $2,500. And I kind of wish I hadn't, because I feel like knowing what I know today and having the eBay reputation that we have, I think I probably could have commanded a lot more for it. And I'm sure that I sold it to a reseller, which is fine. But at the time we were like $2,500. And then of course we're like, how do we ship this? Cause we'd only been shipping for a year or so. So not super experienced with it. I remember we must have taken 20 or 30 minutes in the kitchen trying to figure out how to make the sink bulletproof so that it would definitely get there. And it did get there. So we were really happy with that. So yeah, I mean, like when people say, the storage unit stuff is all made up. It's like, no, there's some crazy stuff that you can get in these units. And so that was one of the most interesting storage unit finds that we got.
Wow, absolutely. And let me just clarify what I said earlier. Yes, all kinds of treasures are in storage units. I just think for the TV show, they stage it. But you hear the stories about, oh, there was a dresser in there that was full of cash. And, you know, we found a box of jewelry that had the Hope Diamond in it or whatever, you know, and yeah, the stuff's out there because people squirrel their stuff away in there and it's in there for like, does anybody ever take it out before they die? I mean, I really think I talked to a lady years ago and she says, yeah, I've had this storage unit full of stuff that was my parents and they passed away. And it's, you know, I've had it for 10 years. I really need to do something about it. So add up $100 a month for 10 years, the kind of money that's being spent just to hold this stuff that they're not even looking at and will probably never use again.
And I don't even think most people know what's in there. Like they put some away and they forget.
They don't even know.
Yeah. I mean, we got a unit like this is probably like 6 or 7 years ago now, like this unit that we split with somebody. And when we started opening it up, we were like, we had literally uncovered a treasure trove. There was so much great stuff in this unit that we bought a brand new truck. Like that's how good it was. And when we pulled out, this person had been collecting silver, like ingots and bar and coins and stuff from in the 1970s. And it had all been stashed away in this unit. There was so much of it. We pulled it all out. We put it on a scale. It weighed 100 pounds. It was 100 pounds of silver in this unit.
Oh my gosh.
Plus, I mean, antique teacups. And I mean, that was like, you, every once in a while, you get the unit that you talk about forever. And that was like, I mean, we couldn't even believe what we were uncovering. So we were like, well, we've been kind of thinking about buying a truck for the business. I guess we'll do that now.
I guess we can. Well, and that's the problem is with decision making. I've helped people after a death or clean out a unit or whatever. And help them sort through things and, you know, trash, sell, give to a relative, whatever. And that's the sticking point is the decision-making. They have this stuff. Maybe some of it's sentimental, probably a lot of it is. And then some of it has value and they just can't make the leap to, okay, let's sell this. They don't know what to do with it. They don't know if they should keep it so they can look at it 10 years from now, or if they should have given it to somebody, they're afraid of making a wrong decision. And so they don't make a decision. That's their decision is not making one. So they give up because they feel so defeated that it's overwhelming. I don't know what to do. And it's not laziness. It's not, you know, these are smart, educated people. It's that emotional connection that is hard to break when it's like, this was my grandmother's and I remember going to her house and seeing this and I don't know if I should sell it. And maybe my kids want it. And I think that's the reason that these storage units are full and they keep building more of them because it just is this endless stream of people in this situation of not knowing what to do.
Yeah. And I mean, if we think about ourselves as professional resellers, we get that same analysis paralysis too. And we're supposed to be really good at this. So it makes sense, you know, that would happen to somebody. Like it's like, no wonder. I mean, like I just said, we've got these two statues been sitting for a decade in this box and we're like one day, you know, or you can't decide. You're like, I don't know if is this worth $100 or $1,000? Like, what do I do? I'll put it on the shelf, you know,
and then I went through that last weekend. I was packing up my personal stuff to move. And I just decided some of these things are just not going to another state. Called my siblings. Do you want this? Do you want this? I've been the family historian dragging this stuff around. I don't want to do it anymore. It's a burden. Like you said, it has energy and it's an energy suck. And so, you know, it was like, I haven't looked at this thing since the last time I moved. No, I'm not moving it again. I'm going to donate it. Or I went through all my photo albums that I've been dragging around for 10 years, like a lot of pounds of that. And I just went through them and took out the pictures I wanted. And a lot of them were like my ex-husband's family. Like, why do I even have these? And I took them out of the albums and put them in like a small Rubbermaid carry handle tub, you know, like just a small one. They all fit. This is what I'm taking. And the rest of them went into the dumpster. And it was so freeing. It was so liberating to be like, well, a lot of them have been scanned and are on my computer anyway. So I don't even need the physical photograph anymore. But it was just stuff like that, that not bringing this, not bringing this, not bringing. And I think maybe if you move more often, you're forced to make some of these decisions. Goodwill really likes me this week because I've been donating things. But when you're in one place for decades, it just accumulates. It's like it multiplies overnight. And then when you do want to move, it's like, my God. And I'm like, I am supposed to be a minimalist. How do I have all this? You know?
So. Yeah, I feel that. I mean, I moved a lot when I was a kid, lots and lots. So we're always purging. And like, by the time I moved out into my own place when I was like 21, like I didn't have anything and I had to get it all again because like all that moving, I ended up with like nothing. So I've always had like this weird relationship with stuff where like I didn't have a lot and I didn't felt like I need a lot. And now I have like more stuff than I've ever had, but I don't really want it. It's all for sale.
Right. Yeah. It's like a minimalist yet a reseller. It's like two worlds colliding.
Yes. Somehow it works.
Okay, let's talk about some more things that you've sold, because with 7,000 items in your inventory, you've sold a lot of things.
I have some fun ones. So last summer, so one of the things we love to do with sourcing, we love to source in the US. So we love to go on road trips and hit estate sales. It's just a whole different animal. And we were down in Southern California. We were outside San Bernardino and we went to an estate sale on the last day. It was a 4-day sale and we were there on the last day. So there wasn't a lot left, but we were kind of looking around and thinking, gosh, this sale probably would have been really good if we'd been here at the beginning. Oh, well, we'll see what we can find. So I remember we spent $20 in total. We bought about 5 things. And one of the things actually had 2 great scores from that. And I never talk about the second one because the first one was so good. But the second one was actually really good too. Anyway, I got this piece of cast iron, just like a hunk of cast iron, had a plate on it plaque. I could tell it was really old, but I didn't know what it was. But I'm like, for $2, I can't say no to this. It's like cool steampunk thing. Like someone will give me $40 or $50 for it. Like, it's awesome. So I took it and I started to do some research and I realized it was the base of one of the original payphones. And it didn't have the phone part, like the, you know, the earpiece, just the base and a 5-cent slot. And I started doing research and I found all of them had 25-cent slots and mine had a 5-cent slot. So I'm like, this must be really early. And I looked in there, cleaned it up. I found a patent date on it of 1898. I'm like, this is cool. I'm going to put it up for auction. So put it up for auction on eBay. And we were eating dinner as the auction was ending. And the auction ended at $665.55. I paid $2.
Oh, my. For this piece. Wonderful.
Or like, there's all the gas for our road trip, like just paid. And I mean, that was amazing. And then it just like, it overshadows the other great find, which was for $7. We had got a World War II military field desk. Like they would put a typewriter in it and carry it out to the field during war times. And we got that for $7 and sold it for $300. And like, that's nothing compared to the payphone.
That's amazing. Some interesting finds. Yeah.
Oh, I just love it. I mean, sourcing in Vancouver is fun because this is a really wealthy city. There's tons of money here, so you can get a lot of really high-end things. But when you go to the States, like the unusual, unique, like cool items that people just hold on to for like a century, it just amazes me. Like you don't find that stuff in Canada.
Really? Okay. And I mean, that happens. People are in the same home for decades and decades. And sometimes a family member will just take it over and they'll just move in. And they don't clean it out.
Nope.
So stuff just, there's a bunch of stuff in the attic. I'll go look at it one day, or they just, they don't pay attention to it. So eventually at some point it's going to come out of there.
Yep.
Yeah.
And hopefully I'm there to get it.
I know, that's where we come in. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say we're vultures. But, you know, we seize the opportunity.
Yes, opportunists. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yes. Well, opportunists can also have like a negative connotation.
It can.
If you're doing shady things, but, you know.
But for me, it's about respecting the items and keeping them out of landfill. And at the point, at the time in which the family pulls all that stuff out of the closet it's been in for years and years, you know, that if they don't know what it is or what to do with it, it's eventually going to get trashed unless someone like us comes along and finds that perfect buyer like we were just talking about. And so for me, I think, I feel like we're doing a service. It's like almost an environmental service.
Absolutely. Know? Yeah. I love the recycling aspect because I don't even want to think about how many items went to landfills that collectors or just regular people who are nostalgic about those items that they want. It's just, it would be mind blowing to know that fact, how many things went to a landfill or gone forever.
I don't even want to know. I mean, I know.
I
have a beautiful gold jewelry collection that mostly came from the trash. I call it my garbage gold.
And don't you feel garbage gold? And don't you feel like you're kind of like beating the system or getting away with something when you do that? You know, I found this in the trash and it's an amazing item and I'm keeping it.
It just upsets me that there's so much waste like that, you know, and I mean, I think there's enough. One of the reasons I love supporting other resellers through my podcast is just because like there's enough stuff in this world for all of us to thrive. Like there's just so much, right? We just got to figure out how to get it.
And you're young. What year were you born?
79. Not that young.
Well, I mean, but you're not like a senior citizen that is valuing all this old stuff. I mean, you see it now. You see the opportunities. You see how the cycle works. And I love that you care about recycling because, frankly, I'm a little worried about what the world's going to be like in 20 years with all this trash and plastic and, you know, how it's affecting the environment. And there's enough of us resellers to make a difference. You know, we recycle packaging materials. I do. I never buy anything.
Never.
And, you know, we're saving things from the landfill and supporting thrift stores and, you know, all the places we get stuff. So maybe we can make a difference. I know a lot of resellers like that recycling aspect of it. So, okay. What else you got on your list?
Oh gosh. Okay, cool. Okay. So I have a story that, well, it's only partially a sales story because we still have some of the items. This is a good one from a yard sale that my husband went to a few years ago. And this family, for whatever reason, this is rare, but this family was no early birds and they were really strict about it. They said, you'll let you in as an early bird if you pay $20. And nobody wanted to pay the $20, so they all stayed outside. And my husband was like, $20, that's not much of a risk. I'm going in. He gives them the $20. I mean, he came out there with a truck full of amazing like vintage Dungeons and Dragons stuff. But the highlight was the guy says, oh, yeah, I've got, you know, some hockey cards if you want to take a look. And usually hockey cards are like, blah, whatever. They're all from the 80s and 90s and nobody cares. This was the entire set of OPG from Wayne Gretzky's rookie year. And there was not one Gretzky card, not two Gretzky rookie cards, but three Wayne Gretzky rookie cards in this box, in addition to the entire set of cards from that year. And the OPG Canada produced Wayne Gretzky rookie is the, you know, that's the holy grail of hockey cards. And boom, three of them. I walked in with three of them that day. And I mean, he paid, I think, $150 for that entire box. Graded, you know, those cards, one of them was quite low grade. Two of them are very, very high grade. So just depending what they ever come back as, you know, they can be worth between $10,000 and $150,000, depending on what the grade comes back as, if we get them officially graded and authenticated, which we haven't done. But one of them we did sell, so off it went. So it's still a selling story, and we sold all the Dungeons and Dragons stuff, too. That one was really, really thrashed. So I think a few hundred.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, at least it paid for all the other cards that mm-hmm. you get to them. That's just gravy.
Yeah. And I mean, I have another story. Recently, one of the things we like to do, there's like a nice preserved like forest near us, and we like to go for walks there. But when we go, we always take our truck, and I check like Craigslist or Facebook to see if anyone's giving away something for free that we could maybe pick up on the way to like pay for gas. So I find this guy's got giving away two storage chests, like old, you know, toy chests. I'm like, those are cool. Like, why don't we go get those? They're free. It's on the way. So I message the guy. He calls me back. We go, we show up. We're like, what's going on here? And he's like, they're like, yeah, our parents passed and we're just getting rid of everything in the house. And we're like everything in the house? And they said, yeah, everything. My husband spots a license plate sticking out of a box. He says, so that old license plate, you don't want that? They're like, no. And there's two more boxes of them in the garage if you want those. So he's like, okay. So he brings them out. And then the guy called us back a week later with two more boxes. So we ended up with over 200 of these vintage license plates. And they went all the way back to 1914, I think was the earliest one in there. And that's a small collectibles category that not a lot of people know, but they can be super lucrative. And the best one we got in there, we sold for, I think, $460 US. And we just sold one last week for $360 US. You know, they're all worth between 20 and, you know, like upwards of $20 each. And we had over 200 of them. So it was like, it was a crazy score. Like just
so absolutely. The ones that sold, what states were they from? Do you remember?
So there's lots of BC ones because that's where we're living. But they were actually mostly British Columbia, Alberta, but like, which is actually great because, you know, Canada with 10% of the population has 10% of the motor vehicles, has 10% of, so people who collect license plates want the Canada ones because they're harder to find. So that's why we did really well with them. But there was a New York, I think a New York 1914. I can't remember if we've sold it or not. But yeah, like they went way back. California ones do really well. Mm-hmm. People like certain ones. And yeah, it's amazing. Probably added up maybe $6,000 to $8,000 worth of inventory. And we're like, oh, we're eBay sellers. We're, you know, like this is all going online. And they're like, yeah, it's fine. They don't care. They're going to get $7 million for that house when they sell it.
Yeah.
So take
it. So it out of there. I've been that person that has moved and it's like, you know I can sell some of this, but I don't have time. Like this move came up really fast. And so like, I don't have time or I don't have the bandwidth in my brain to do this. And, you know, if you're moving suddenly with job transfer or, you know, going to be a caregiver for someone in another state or something like that, where you've got to make some quick decisions and, mm-hmm. and get on the road and get there. So that happens. And, you know, we all see things at estate sales, thrift stores, and we're like, why was this donated? Why is this for sale? This is a great item. And, you know, if you knew the backstory, you'd understand. It's not like, oh, that person's stupid and they just threw it away. Sometimes they don't have a choice.
It's just, 100%.
Yeah.
I have another fun one from the trash.
Okay.
So sometimes we get like junk guys who come and they're like on their way to the dump, but they have like some stuff and they wonder if we want it. So this guy came and he's like, oh, I got some comic books. He knows we like those. So we looked at them and they were junk, which like usually comic books are they're junk, right? Like most comics aren't worth anything, but they were like Archies and stuff like 70s. They're not worth that much. We're like, we can sell these in lots. We gave him a small amount of money for those and a few other things. And we're like, okay, let's quickly sort these out so that they're not like taking up space. So we start sorting them out. We're flipping through, it's like Archie, ugh, whatever, like lots of 20, lots of 30, whatever. And then out from the middle of the pile falls Incredible Hulk 181. And if you know comic books, you know that this is the first appearance of Wolverine in any comic book. And it is it's so hard to find this book. It was printed in the 1970s. It's a holy grail. It's extremely difficult. And we could not understand why this Marvel title was like fell out of the middle of a bunch of Archies. It was just like one of those moments that they would have on the show where they would put this amazing thing in the middle of a bunch of trash. It literally happened. And we're just like dancing around our shop. Like how? Cause that book in the condition it's in maybe in today's market would fetch about $4,000. So we just like couldn't even believe it. Like how, you know, out of this pile of junk. So that one's not a sales story because we still have it. Cause like there's certain things that we hang on to kind of, if we feel like the, if it's small, does it take up space and we think the value is going to go up, we'll hang on to it. And I'm sure that it will. Cause that one was on its way to the garbage, which means more of them are every single day on their way to
That's
the garbage.
Right. Like how many more of these were thrown away? And so I'm holding on to this now. How do you have it priced?
It's not for sale at the moment. Okay. Just kind of base pricing on, there's different ways, different websites that kind of give you an idea of like sold history for like over a period of time that can give you an idea of the market value. During the pandemic, comic values were extremely inflated. Everything was going way higher than market and now things have fallen back down. So we're kind of just like waiting for that to turn around again. And in the meantime, we sell all of our so-so comics. Because we have quite a large collection and we have maybe, I want to say 700 or 800 listings of comic books on eBay. It's about 10% of our store.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah. Now, do you have, or your husband have specialized knowledge in that area?
We built it over time. It's like everything, you know, it just takes so long to learn. We still don't know everything there is to know about comic books, especially modern ones. But it was actually a storage locker find that got us into comics. I think there were 8 or 9 boxes in this unit that we had bought. And we were like, what is the deal with comic books? We don't really get it. And we, you know, tried to look them up. There was one really nice book in that lot, I remember, that we sold. But that's how we got into it. We were like, oh, comic books are interesting. And we didn't really understand that world at all until we found some. And that's the great thing about reselling too, is like sometimes you buy something and you're like, I don't know what that is. And over time you become really knowledgeable in a particular category and you can leverage that knowledge to make tons more money. And if we hadn't found those comic books that day, I mean, who knows, we might've never gotten into that category.
That's great. But I wanted to save the last few minutes for you to talk about your podcast, and you said a YouTube channel too?
Yeah. So I started my podcast a couple of summers ago. It's called The Business of Reselling. And like I said earlier, the question I wanted to explore was, can you do $1 million in gross sales in reselling, particularly in like the collectibles and like one of a kind categories? Because, okay, sure, you can do it with Amazon and like new products and stuff like that. But I was like, can we do this in our vintage like realm that we're operating in? So that's why I started it. And I also wanted to take like traditional business problems that I've learned about through my formal education and apply those to reselling to show other resellers, like, this is a real business. And if you treat it like one and you look at things, you know, objectively and sort of rationally from a business standpoint, it's going to help you scale your business up if that's what you want to do. And so that's why I called it The Business of Reselling. So businessofreselling.com is where anybody can go to sign up for it on whatever podcatcher they like. The podcast and some videos that I like to do end up on YouTube, and that's youtube.com/@StorageWarriorPodcast, because Storage Warrior is the name of our business.
Okay.
And so that's, yeah, like I said, we loved Storage Wars. So we were like, how similar can we be? we went with Storage Warrior.
But you do have to be a warrior, because some of those are pretty overwhelming and you have to have a vehicle to get all the stuff out. Because what do you have, like 48 hours to get everything out once you
buy
it? And then you have to have a place to put everything. If it's a lot, you got to be able to sort through it. You can't just do it in the back of your truck and take some to Goodwill, because if there's a lot of stuff, you want to look it up and evaluate it. So you have to have a place to put everything.
Yes. So. And we have literally lived up to our name. Like last year we found an online auction. It was actually on Vancouver Island. So you got to take a ferry to get there. The ferry takes 90 minutes. We won 2 units based on photos and we were like, okay, they were huge. Like one was like an 8x20 and the other one was like a 10x15 or something. And they were packed. We drove over there in my little car, rented a 26-foot truck from U-Haul on that side, spent the entire weekend packing these trucks full and then drove it back on the ferry. Like, no kidding, Storage Warrior. Like we did what we had to and got all that stuff over and made a ton of money.
Good for you. I mean, that's how you got 7,000 items.
I think we bought 7,000 items that day.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, great. Did you want to answer one of the questions at the end?
Answer one of which questions?
About like a podcast or a book you're reading. Doesn't sound like you have a lot
right.
to read.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. Reading. Yeah, you know, I'm actually, it's so funny because one of my degrees is in English Lit. And so I've always beaten myself up over the years for not being a big reader. And I keep trying to get back into fiction. And then I read 60 pages of a book and then I put it down and I'm like, what's wrong with me? Like, why don't I read?
Well, the internet is a distraction.
So, but I am reading a book right now. I finally just allowed myself to not read fiction and read the types of books that I do enjoy, which are usually business or travel related. And so right now I am reading a book by Bill Bryson. And of course, the name of it is totally escaping me. I love him too. Yeah, I've read a lot of his books. I can't remember the name.
They're but this fun. He's like sort of sarcastic and sort of tongue in cheek, but you know, good information woven in there.
Yeah, he's quite silly, and he wrote this book about going back to England after 20 years or something of like not having been there, and going back to all the places he visited in his youth and his experiences of how they changed and stuff like that. And so that one's really fun. I recommend like any Bill Bryson book if people just kind of want to get away from like clutter and imagine places far, far away. He always writes lots of great travel literature.
Mm-hmm. He sure does. Okay. Well, wow. I had no idea we'd be diving into all these topics. So I'm definitely going to have you back on in a few months to talk about some of the things you specialize in, because you have learned a lot, you know, you're self-taught doing this. And I think that information will be valuable for sellers who haven't delved into sports cards and license plates and comic books and all the things that you know a lot about. So thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy 7,000 item day and coming on my podcast. And I look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, that was super fun. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
On to today's trivia question. Since Jess mentioned license plates, how much do some of the most collectible license plates sell for? Here's a few seconds to think it over. Okay, here are a few sold listings on Terapeak, just so you will know what's possible. A vintage 1926 Hawaii license plate in good condition sold for $3,305 on auction. A set of Ohio antique vintage 1908 porcelain license plates sold for $2,900 on auction. Another Ohio license plate from 1908 sold for $2,400 on auction. A vintage 1970s Hawaii license plate sold for $2,000. That was a fixed priced listing. And a vintage 1976 Hawaii license plate sold for $2,000 also. So there's just something to think about. If you've not considered looking for and selling license plates, they're flat, easy to ship, don't take up much room, and they're highly collectible, so the perfect item. Okay, next week, my guest is Maggie, who is known on the Facebook group as the Resale Rebel. Unfortunately, she came down with COVID, and we had to reschedule our recording session until she was feeling better. Maggie specializes in vintage clothing and has some really useful information for anyone who wants to learn more about that category. She sells other items as well. Thank you again, listeners, for spending the last hour with us. I appreciate all of you. Make it a great week on eBay. Bye for now.